I call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, April 14th, 2026, and the time is 9 a.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Dunbar, Senator Myers, Senator Kawasaki, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and I'm Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Klayman, here comes Senator Klayman. Senator Rauscher has a bill being heard in another committee, so he'll be joining us a bit later. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Susan for keeping the audio going and keeping the records. Today we have two bills before us. We have Senate Bill 280 and Senate Bill 275. We're going to continue with Senate Bill 280 with Department of Revenue. Mr. Dan Stickle, the Chief Economist of the Tax Division, is with us in person, and I will welcome him forward. And let me see who's online with us. Online is Ryan Farnsworth. He's Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law, available for questions. And we'll see if other people jump on as well. We were going through the presentation on the fiscal note. And yesterday we ended at about slides 29 and 30. So we'll get back there. Welcome, Mr. Stickle. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you again. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. Before I jumped back into the presentation, I wanted to correct on the record two things that I did misspeak on yesterday. So in relation to the municipalities that the TAPS flows through, the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, the three primary municipalities receiving revenue from that are the North Slope Borough, the Fairbanks North Slope Borough, and then Valdez. And there are smaller TAPS-related impacts to Anchorage, Mat-Su Borough, Whittier, and Cordova. And then there was a slide where we had talked about what the state property tax would be for the gas pipeline under current law versus the proposal in the bill. I misspoke on that yesterday because I was forgot to reference a provision of the bill where under the alternative volumetric tax, for a portion of the line located in a municipality, the municipality receives all of the revenue, whereas under the current property tax, there's a split between the state and municipalities. In any case, for 2035, under current law and our baseline modeling assumptions, the state would receive $239 million of property tax. And under the alternative volumetric tax, that would be $9 million for a $230 million difference. For the municipalities, it would be $497 million of current property tax. And then under the bill, it would be $63.6 million of alternative volumetric tax.
Very good. Thank you for that. I also wanted to mention something that was shared yesterday. I will add, incidentally, that Matt Kissinger has joined online, Commercial Director, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. Yesterday, it was mentioned that the initial gas supply for the pipeline in phase one would come from Pantheon, Great Bear. I touched base with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. They would have to approve the offtake of the gas, and at this point, Great Bear has not applied for any offtake authorizations. So I just wanted to put that out for information. Senator Klayman.
Thank you. Just for some clarity, Mr. Stickle, you just ran off a number of figures, and when I'm looking at the slides, if you could actually tell us where the figures you just read off go on the slides that we have.
Sure, Senator Klayman, through the chair. So the current law and proposed law property tax and alternative volumetric tax numbers to the state would be from slide 30 and 32, also relating to an earlier slide, which would be slide 18, where we lay out the alternative volumetric tax by municipality and for the state.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
So could you, could you tell us which spaces to put the numbers you gave us? I'm being the village idiot because I don't really necessarily know immediately the figures you read off where they fit on these pieces that we're looking at.
Sure, Senator Klayman, through the chair. So I would be looking at slide 18, and then this shows the revenues that the state would receive from the alternative volumetric tax. Some of the questions from the committee were, if the project were to go forward under current law, what would the expected property tax value be? Looking at 2035, for North Slope Borough, the expected property tax would be $288 million. For Fairbanks North Star Borough, it would be $0.4 million. For Denali Borough, it would be zero. For Matsu Borough, it would be $30.5 million. For Kenai, it would be $178 million. For a total to the municipalities of $497 million. And then for the state, it would be $239 million for a total property tax of $736 million under current law.
This is all in the FY 2035 column?
These would be annual revenues. So correct, Senator Klayman, through the chair. Under the current law, with our baseline capital assumptions, there would be about a $736 million per year property tax burden from the project, and that would be reduced to about $74 million under this bill.
Follow up, Senator Klayman?
No, not at this point.
Other questions, Senator Kawasaki?
Just maybe a request to help so that it'd be easier to clarify if we could get something of an estimated impact graph that would state what it would be had it not changed. So, you know, just all those numbers that you read off in 2035 would be put into a graph. And then, I mean, I don't know how you would estimate, but, you know, make some sort of a judgment call on how to estimate what that approximate would be.
Sure.
So that we could kind of figure out like lost revenue to municipalities.
Okay, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. So I'm seeing that it may be helpful to provide something similar to slide 18 under current law.
Yes.
Yes.
And we will provide that.
Very good. That would be great. Other questions, comments? Senator Klayman.
I take it you'll be doing that not just for FY 2035 under current law, but the whole range of columns.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, yes. So what we'll do is we'll provide this slide under what it looks like under current law. I think that would answer a lot of these questions.
Yes, I think so too. I see nothing further. Very good. So are we moving now to slide 29 or 30?
Sure, we can.
Or,
we could briefly start with slide 29, which is, I think, roughly where we left off yesterday. So this slide summarized the key outputs of our modeling under current law and our baseline assumptions. This would be if the project went forward under current law. And so we saw what the revenues were to the various stakeholders. And then as a reminder, the top set of numbers here are cash flows. So for the upstream and midstream, these represent gross revenues before any costs. And then highlighting the break-even cost of supply numbers here, which is $4.86 in 2033 for in-state, and then $9.07 for LNG exported. And then those become important numbers as we compare it to different scenarios and different market conditions.
Mr. Stickle, just for clarification, gas commodity charge, is that the price at the wellhead?
Chair Giesel, yes.
All right. I don't see any other questions.
All right. So slide 30 shows a chart of annual state revenues under the current law analysis. Again, this would be if the project went forward under current law without property tax relief. So we're looking at a little over $200 million per year of property tax, around $600 million per year if you include royalties and corporate tax, and then about $1 billion per year total. These are revenues just to the state once we add in the production tax impacts.
So a question on this slide, Mr. Stickle. At year 2033, that peak, and then it plateaus, this must be after the export facility is fully functional. True?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain the TBTU per year, 1150? How does that compare to the 3.5 billion is usually the number we see for when the LNG is fully being exported? This is a different measurement. So how does that, is that, are you assuming that same amount being exported?
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So the left axis is the revenues, and then the right axis is the volumes. This one's been labeled in trillions of BTUs per year, which a BTU in 1,000 cubic feet have a rough equivalency, but that top threshold would be equivalent to the 3.5 billion cubic feet per day of full capacity of the project.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, good question. All right, I see no further questions.
Okay, so slide 31 summarizes some of the key outputs of the modeling under the proposed legislation and with the baseline assumptions. So everything the same as slide 29, except we implement SB 280 and the alternative volumetric tax. Under this analysis through 2062, there's $22.5 billion of state revenues, which is $7.2 billion less than current law. There's $4 billion of municipal revenues, which is $13.3 billion less. There's $60 billion to the upstream producers. That is the same as the prior analysis. And then there's $68.5 billion to the midstream in revenue, which is $1.5 billion less than under current law. And why is that less is because the project, the cost to operate the project is less with the lower property tax burden, and we are assuming a 10% return to the midstream owner. And so they're making a 10% return on a lower base when we provide the property tax relief. In terms of cost of supply, under our baseline, we get a $4.43 break-even price for the in-state cost of supply, which is 43 cents per 1,000 cubic feet reduction to in-state, and then $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet, which is a 59 cent per 1,000 cubic feet reduction to the price that would allow the project to break even in the market for delivered LNG.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, I'm looking at your cost of supply summaries. The in-state versus the LNG, the gas commodity charge, gas treatment plant toll, and pipeline toll are slightly higher on the LNG portion. Why is that?
Sure, Senator Myers, through the chair. So the gas commodity, the commodity charge for LNG includes some additional treatment costs.
Follow-up, Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you. I thought we just clarified that that's at the wellhead, and so treatment would come later. But then you've got your gas treatment plant toll, And that's, I mean, if all the gas is run through the same treatment plant, it should be the same, you know, the producers don't care if it's getting sold in Anchorage or if it's getting sold in Japan, they're going to charge the same price. The gas treatment plant, it's the same plant. It's all going to get charged the same. It's the same pipeline. That's all going to get charged the same. The LNG plant and the ship and the overseas shipping, of course, that's different, but we're talking about the same gas running through the same infrastructure. So why is it different?
Sure, Senator Myers, to the chair. I'm going to use a lifeline.
Okay.
And who would you like, Mr. Farnsworth or Mr. Kissinger?
I was hoping I had Mr. Herbert, my
sadly
commercial
no
analyst online. I'll follow up with that.
Okay.
I'd like to
thank you.
Clarify that. I know we have an answer, and he could answer it off the top of his head, but I'll get that for you guys.
Okay.
So I have a question. So you've pointed out the change in revenue for each of these. How much will this save the consumer? Have you calculated down to that level?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So we've done some initial analysis looking at after contracts expire for NSTAR in particular in 2033, what are the options that exist there, and how does the AKLNG project compare to imported gas being the primary concerns there. And so we looked at a 2023 study by BRG that was done for NSTAR, and that had a cost of imported gas. We inflated that price up to $2033, and it came out to about $17 per 1,000 cubic feet for imported gas into the market. Our baseline here for in-state gas would be $4.43 per 1,000 cubic feet, and so that would be a savings of about $12.50 per 1,000 cubic feet. Looking at NSTAR customers as a total, which consume about 34 billion cubic feet per year, that would be about a $358 million annual savings, or about $10.7 billion over a 30-year time horizon. And we looked at NSTAR in particular because they have some readily available information around number of customers and exactly what their prices are. If we extrapolated that from the 34 billion cubic feet that NSTAR is using to a larger number, such as the 65 to 70 billion cubic feet that are consumed in the inlet, or potentially a larger number if there's, incentive. If new demand is incentivized, things like if there is a Fairbanks spur line, some sort of an industrial base load consumer, could be data center, agrium, sales to mines, then it would be the savings could be significantly higher than those OnStar only numbers.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. On that question of the savings to consumers, it's 43 cents per MCF is what the savings is for the property tax cuts, correct?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, so the 43 cents per 1,000 cubic feet is the comparison of the delivered price to utilities under, if you assume the project goes forward under current law versus under this bill.
So follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
To do a comparison on how much the people of Alaska would be giving up. So the state property taxes are reduced by $230 million, which divide that by 600,000 Alaskans comes out to $383 per person. The Muni cut is $434 million, which is probably $700-$800 per person. But the Munis are separate. But I guess the point I'm that is curious to me is that the amount of I checked with NSTAR, the amount of natural gas that the average Anchorage residential customer uses is 139 MCF per year. And when you multiply that by 43 cents, you get $58.38, which means that the average household in Anchorage with that 43 cent savings is saving $58.38, but they're giving up $239 million in state property taxes, which is the equivalent of $383 per person. So a household of four is giving up almost $1,500 to get in potential PFDs or potential state services in exchange for $58.38 of savings. Does that sound about right?
Senator Willikowski through the chair. So, yeah, I mean, I think the question is, what is the alternative? And if your view is that this project will not go forward under current law, then the comparison would be, you know, what is the alternative source of gas, you know, via imports, which is what I quoted. If your view is that this project will go forward under current law, then the numbers you cited would be more accurate.
And I guess that's what we're all trying to figure out is that 43 cents savings going to make the difference in the project? And as we have these hearings, maybe we can get some a little bit more data to help us come to that conclusion.
Thank you. Senator Myers, I know you have a question. I wanted to let you know, and Mr. Stickle, that David Herbert is now online, and you had asked a question previously. But Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment to put everything into context, Madam Chair. I paid my gas bill at home last night, and the Fairbanks charge for gas right now to the consumer, I'm not entirely certain what the wholesale charge is, but $24.90, in case anybody's interested. So that's what's at stake for Fairbanks with this project. So thank you.
All right. And Mr. Sickle, you had wanted Mr. Herbert to answer a question that Senator Myers had asked.
Yeah, I had, Madam Chair, I was looking at the cost of supply charts that Mr. Stickle had on both slides 29 and 31. I believe they're the same on these three pieces anyway. The LNG break-even price versus the in-state break-even price, the gas commodity charge, the gas toll, gas treatment plant toll, and the pipeline toll are all slightly higher for the LNG price. And I'm just curious as to why, since it's the same gas and the same infrastructure.
So through the chair, for the record, David Herbert, Department of Revenue, Tax Division, Commercial Analyst. A very good question, and it's something we try and highlight in these, is that these cost of supply are based off of the price to the end consumer, be it the utilities or LNG customers. And as a result, the totals presented here are based off of the output volumes. So for the LNG, there's additional fuel that needs to be transported down the gas line and processed in order to run the liquefaction plant, and that adds to the cost there across the board.
Senator Myers, follow up?
Yeah, just to clarify. So effectively what I'm hearing is because of the extra volume needed, I'm assuming that means we're going to need to run pipelines out to Point Thompson or a couple of the other North Star, Endicott, something like that to get the gas. And so you're factoring that the cost of that extra infrastructure being built into those extra costs going up a little bit.
Good. Through the chair. In this case, those costs are already baked into both of these things, but it's the, in order to run the liquefaction plant itself, a certain amount of additional gas needs to be transported just for that. And instead of letting the cost associated with that gas get incorporated into both sides of it, they're only shown on the LNG, so the in-state customers aren't subsidizing that.
Oh, okay. All right. It's the cost of the LNG. It's the extra gas that is necessary in order to run the LNG plant, and that's just back added into the other pieces. Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's exactly it. Thank you. Through the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Herbert. Further questions on slide 31? Seeing none, I'll let you go on, Mr. Sickle.
All right, thank you again for the record. Dan Stickle. So slide 32 is our same annual revenue chart under the proposed analysis. Looks very similar to the current loss slide, except it's about $230 million per year lower across the board due to removing that property tax and replacing it with the alternative volumetric tax. So state revenue from the AKLNG project with this bill passed is looking at about $800 million per year total.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. First, just to reiterate what I said yesterday, one of my primary goals in this bill, if I'm going to support it, is to prevent that happening in 2028 through 2032, where our revenues go negative. If we're going to produce that much revenue in the future, there's no reason to have any period where we can't put those costs out into the future. So that's one. The second is, you know, I think if you were a layperson looking at this graph, it looks like the government revenue, the total government revenue here, approaches, you know, is quite close to the line. And on the previous graph on 30, it's actually over the line at time. And you might interpret that as saying the government is taking the vast majority of the revenues, if that is indeed the revenues. But if you look at the prior slide, and you've got the upstream owners and the midstream owners and all of them together, that adds up to $177.5 billion approximately. And about 72.5% of it is taken by the owners, and 28.5% is taken by the government. So the government, less than 30% of the total revenue is captured by the government, which is probably fair. The vast majority of the revenue goes to the producers and the midstream owners. So I guess when I'm at my question is, why doesn't this graph reflect that? So why isn't there the gap between the lines and the revenue equal to 70% of the revenues produced? Does that make sense? So again, if you look at the prior slide, 72.5% of all revenue related to this project is captured by the upstream owners and the midstream owners. Good. But this graph makes it look like it's a much tighter gap between the revenues produced and the state and all government revenue. So what am I missing there?
Sure. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So this chart shows two things. This shows total gas sales on the right axis in the dotted line, and then total state revenues only in the stacked bar charts. So this chart is only looking at that state revenue number and how that breaks out into the different components. We could certainly prepare a chart that shows all the revenues to the different entities, and that would demonstrate that the revenue to the state is a fraction of the total revenue generated by the project.
Yeah, can I follow, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up, Senator.
Then I don't understand what the dotted line was. I thought the dotted line was trying to illustrate the total revenue generated by the project. Uh-oh. And Senator Myers is shaking his head. But why does the dotted line exist if that's not what it's showing?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So what the dotted line represents is gas sales from the project. And the reason we included that is we wanted to show the start of the project where there are no gas sales. We wanted to show what the impact on state revenue is for the first couple of years when there's only in-state gas sales. And then we wanted to show the ramp-up period where the full export project is coming online. And then to show that the significant state revenues really do start in 2033 when the project is fully operational.
Follow-up question?
Yes, follow-up.
So I don't think this is intentional by the by the Department of Revenue. But that is a wildly misleading graph because people look at it and they associate the dotted line with the revenue on the y-axis on the left. And what you're saying is no, the dotted line only applies to on the right. You see what I mean? Why not just make a dotted line that tracks with the revenues, which would also track with the gas sales, but they'd show a vastly different – they would show – this line would go way three times off the graph to show all the profits being made or all the revenue being generated, perhaps not profits. Does that make sense?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I understand the alternative slide that you're discussing. We'd be happy to provide a version of that.
Please don't put this slide into the public like this. Because again, I think it is, unless there's some way to be very clear, because it even says LNG and gas sales, which implies that there's some dollar figure on the bottom there with the dotted line. And again, a person is going to look at this and say, man, the government is taking the vast majority of the revenue being generated here. And if they look at the thing on slide 30, they'll come to the conclusion that the government revenue exceeds the total revenue for a portion. No wonder they need this giant tax break. But that's not at all what this is showing. And okay. Again, I don't think it was intentional. I just think it, I hope we can change this before it goes out for broader public consumption, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, absolutely not intentional. I see that we can improve our labeling on this slide if we're going to include that dotted line, and we'll take a look at that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Myers.
Yeah, just to clarify, Mr. Stickle, I think we've gone back and forth a little bit, but on 29 and 31, when we had the dollar figures for the upstream owners and the midstream owners, I believe you said that that was not profit, that that was just strictly cash flow. And so if we once we subtracted out the upstream and midstream costs, then those the actual profit would be significantly smaller than that. Is that accurate?
Senator Myers, through the chair, that's accurate.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. All right, we say revenue, not profit.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Looking at kind of both let's start at slide 32. Under this proposal, we often talk about how the gas line is going to bring enormous revenue to the state, and particularly, I think, at least when we sit in the legislature, we think, is this going to be a big increase in revenue to state government? And I'm looking at slide 32. Never in a single year do the revenues to the state exceed $1 billion, and I'm not minimizing that $1 billion is no small amount of money to the state, but I think about how much we're drawing annually on the POMV draw from the earnings reserve to fund state government, which is over $3 billion and has been for the last few years. And so I look at this, which shows less than $1 billion coming to the state in the best years. If this project has potential revenue to the state, is there some other means the state can achieve great revenue from this particular project? Because it doesn't look like it's coming from royalties and production taxes. I mean, and again, not to understate that we don't need the revenue, but this doesn't look like a game changer. And so where's the big revenue to the state in the project?
Yeah, Senator Klayman, through the chair. So I would suggest that $800 million a year is a significant increase to state revenue. Looking at gas also.
And I agree it's a significant increase, but it doesn't really change the picture dramatically because that's $800 million is about 25% of the POMV draw from the earnings reserve.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Senator Klayman, I was going to add, gas is a lower value commodity than oil. Mm-hmm. That is a truth. And so there – when you're looking at a gas, there is a lesser amount of profit overall with gas than oil, and that's something to keep in mind.
And I think that's a really important point. that we often forget because we are used to dealing with oil. I'll just interject that. But the other point you make, Senator Klayman, because you're referring to the percent of market value that is available for general fund use, and we are proposing actually reducing the percent of market value percent from 5% down to 4.5% progressively over a five-year period,
right. Yes.
Which if you apply that to this graph, it will hit at about 2032, 2033. I don't have the bill in front of me that's being considered, but we need to take that into consideration also, though this is not our only source of revenue.
Sure.
Thank you for bringing that up, Senator Klayman. Did you have follow-up?
I do have follow-up. And it isn't the question I'm raising is, If there is this potentially more significant win for the state than just what's on these graphs, where is that? Is that somehow that we have ownership interest or greater ownership interest in pieces of the pipeline that will bring us revenue separate from royalties and production taxes?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, so that's certainly an option that the legislature could consider to have an ownership interest. Broader economic impacts, economic development in the state. And then what we haven't really looked at is the impact on exploration and development above and beyond what's in the revenue forecast. And I spoke to that a little bit yesterday in some of the slides, but this idea that when you have a sales mechanism for gas, that it makes exploration and development more attractive generally on the slope.
Further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Do you have any idea what the costs are to the upstream owners to produce $1.50 worth of gas are? Because right now, my understanding is they're injecting like 8 billion cubic feet a day. So they're just re-injecting it. So I would imagine the costs to the producers are pennies, extremely low. Is that probably about right?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we do have assumptions around what the incremental cost of the oil, of the gas and associated new oil will be. Those are baked into the model. I don't have those at my fingertips. But we do have assumptions that we've developed with AGDC.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So profits for industry, I guess. So if you have $1.50 gas, which is what you're estimating, the state's share is $1.50 times, we get a 12.5% royalty, we get a 13% gross tax, so that's 25.5%. That comes out to 38.25 cents. Corporate income tax is a little bit, not as much as probably could be, but the property taxes are very little. So it's maybe 40 cents, I'm guessing. The producers, on the other hand, are getting, if it costs virtually nothing for them. They're just producing it and re-injecting it right now. So they're probably making a dollar an MCF. Is that sound about right?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would have to look at our assumptions to validate that exact number.
Madam Chair,
Senator Wilkowski.
Could you provide us with that data?
Yeah, sure. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we'll be happy to do that. So we do, as I mentioned, we do have assumptions baked into the modeling for incremental costs at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson to produce the gas.
Good. I think the other thing to consider here is what I shared at the outset. The idea that Pantheon is going to be the initial source of gas is a questionable assumption since they haven't applied for gas offtake yet. And so not thinking that there doesn't have to be gas treatment costs at the very beginning is a flawed assumption, in my opinion. But I want to go to Senator Rauscher, who has recently joined us, and welcome. And I'll let you ask your questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In just regards to the question by Senator Wilkowski, you know, when they re-inject or inject, they have different reasons for it, to bring up more oil. Sometimes they have too much gas that comes up because of the oil that they're taking out of the ground. This is not a complete search for gas. This is something that happened along the way, which may be too much for them to reinject just to bring up new oil or whatever. But when you're looking at actually providing the gas that we're providing here and liquefying and getting it in the pipeline, I think that the costs go up considerably, other than why they're reinjecting what you're talking about there and the cost that it seems like it would be almost nil. These are two different types of gas supplies that we're trying to come up with and volume that we're needing. That's just my opinion from working up there.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So go back to Senator Klayman's question about the benefit to the state. You know, we're talking about dollar benefit in terms of direct royalties and taxes. But, I mean, the other benefit to the state would be lower energy costs for residents. Hopefully fewer people leave the state because it gets more affordable to live here. Maybe some businesses become more profitable. We start some businesses. You mentioned Agrium potentially restarting up if they've got a decent, reliable supply. Again, that something gets thrown on the property tax rolls for the Kenai. If other businesses can get started, those increase the property tax rolls locally for a lot of places. Do you have a Department of Revenue? Do you have any modeling that can estimate those types of benefits, even though they aren't necessarily direct benefits to the state treasury because, well, we don't have a broad-based tax? Can you model some of those other benefits to municipalities or to the population in general?
Senator Myers, through the chair, that's something we've been looking at, how we can model those broader economic benefits. I'm not sure that's quite ready for prime time. But, you know, qualitatively, we can certainly speak to some of the what we're looking at. It's things like data centers, like a restart of Agrium plant, like a line out to support mining operations like the Donlin mine, like the Fairbanks spur line. And certainly those have economic impacts that go beyond just the direct revenues.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Myers, I appreciate what you spoke about in terms of opening and restarting businesses and that resulting, of course, in property tax and so forth. But remember, in under 4356.022, all municipal property tax, ad valorem sales tax, municipal gross and net income, license fees, excise, municipal charges, etc., relating to consumption, whatever, are all prohibited. Prohibited during construction, which is the most impactful time. And you see the line there. It actually, the line starts way over in 2022. We're actually in 2026 already. But that prohibition on any municipal taxes of any kind continues until they reach a billion cubic feet, which this optimistically is projecting in 2033. But that's a pretty optimistic projection. So it could be a while before that idea of additional municipal income would come to fruition. Just some practical considerations.
Well, just to that point, Senator Myers. Just that point, Madam Chair. So I understand we may need to clarify that because I think the point of the bill here is to say we don't want to tax them while they're in the middle of construction. And, you know, but again, there will be some spillover effects, and we do want the municipalities and the like to be able to capture those. So I'm all in favor of clarifying that, but, you know, to say I don't think it's quite accurate to say, you know, because that's what the language is in the bill right now, that, you know, for example, the Kenai wouldn't be able to tax the Agrium plant just because they're using the gas, because that doesn't have anything to do with the construction. So I'm just, again, I understand we may need to clarify that, but just thinking about where the benefits go.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
On the pipeline, so can you go back a slide to 31? Okay, so I'm struck by the number, the disparity in cumulative to 2062. You got $22 billion to the state, $22 billion to the feds, $3 billion to muni, $60 billion to upstream, $68 billion to midstream. And I'm trying to figure out what the share is. You know, we talk about a third, a third, a third. for the state feds, upstream, in this case, we got midstream. What profit do you estimate the midstream owners are getting from that $68 billion?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, our model assumes a 10% rate of return for midstream.
So yes, well, that's up, so that'd be $6.8 billion?
Roughly.
Okay. And then on the upstream, any sense of what kind of profit they're looking at?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, don't have that number off the top of my head.
Is that something you can get to us?
Yes.
Thank you.
Very good.
And just curious, yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski. I'm curious about those federal numbers. Why is there a negative federal number from cumulative for 2042?
Sure. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So the federal revenues represent two things. One is a federal corporate income tax, which would be we would assume a slight offset to federal corporate income taxes during the build out phase when there's money being laid out, but also we're assuming benefits from the 45Q credits, which are credits for carbon capture, which would apply to the gas treatment plant, and so those are a positive benefit to the project, but an outlay from the federal government during the initial years of the project.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And is that shift, so those 45Q credits, I assume, go to the upstream owners or the midstream owners? What's your expectation on that? And are you reflecting the shift to those owners in this slide?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So we assume that those 45Q credits are realized by the midstream owner at the gas treatment plant, and that is baked into our modeling, yes.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
What is the value per – explain how you're valuing that. That's – so you got a ton of carbon, maybe – explain where and explain how that's reflected in here and how many tons you're estimating.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski through the chair. So I'll see what I have at my fingertips. I may have to defer this one to my lifeline.
Mr. Would you like Mr. Herbert? Mr. Herbert, welcome. If you could answer the question.
Thank you. So for the record, David Herbert, Department of Revenue, commercial analyst, through the chair. We right now are estimating $7.5 million tons of CO2 removed at the GTP plant per year once everything is at full operations. And that is sequestered, earning a credit per ton of, according to the current 45Q law, which is $85 per ton today, but increases with inflation over time. So by the time the project is running at full capacity, we're talking about $100 per ton of CO2 sequestered, which combining those two numbers together for the first 12 years of the project, which is the length of those 45Q credits, we're talking about approximately approximately $750 million to $900 million over that time frame as credits that are either cashable or immediately transferable from the federal government to the project.
Senator Wilkowski.
Where are you anticipating that carbon will be stored? Is there a well that's been approved? Has there, I know we had approved, given the department the authority to go forward on getting EPA authority to start this process. And have you done that? Where are we at in that process?
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record, Senator Bulikowski through the chair. So that might be a good question for Mr. Kissinger with AGDC.
Of course. Mr. Kissinger, welcome. If you could respond to the question about the sequestration.
Sure. This is Matt Kissinger for the record, Senator Bulikowski through the chair. There are two ways to sequester your CO2 under the 45Q credits. There is the permanent geological sequestration, and then there's use for EOR. As this project's been developed, the base case assumption has always been that the CO2 would be returned to Prudhoe Bay. In fact, it's a distal part of the reservoir, which is the target area for it to go into. And by putting it into Prudhoe Bay, you're just by default taking the EOR credits rather than the permanent geologic storage credits. The enhanced oil recovery mechanism is the pressure itself from putting those molecules back into the reservoir. And then, you know, there's also the potential that the CO2 would be somewhat miscible and be able to withdraw more oil just to be in the reservoir.
Question, a further follow-up, Senator? Let's see, Senator Dunbar, you were next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we go forward one slide, and you must have mentioned this, but I missed it. What's going on in 2038 here again? So there are two different shades of blue here. So I think that's the property tax in ABT, but it might be the production tax. It just disappears for a year and then it comes back. Could you explain that again?
Sure, Senator Dunbar through the chair. So we are assuming that for Point Thompson in particular, that there's two major capital outlays associated with expanding that field. One that occurs prior to full exports and then another in 2038. So that represents an expected reduction to production tax in that one year when we're expecting a major outlay of funds at Point Thompson.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
And just remind me, that production taxes for both oil and gas or just production taxes on the gas?
Senator Dunbar through the chair. So this is total production tax. The production tax due to the state is paid on a statewide basis. So we combine the oil and the gas from the producers.
Senator Dunbar, follow up.
Just Madam Chair, if this all goes forward, I think the legislature in 2036 is going to have a pretty detailed discussion about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. And just to clarify, Senator Dunbar through the chair, so these are incremental production tax revenues above and beyond our spring revenue forecast. And so in 2038, we would still be expecting additional revenue above and beyond the existing forecast, just not hundreds of millions of dollars like we are in other years.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bulikowski was asking you some questions about, or actually it's a question from Mr. Kissinger asking about the CO2 stuff, but I think he also asked the status of an EPA application to get permitted, and I'd never heard an answer to that. Mr. Kissinger,
can you respond to that question? I believe it's an AOGCC question, but you may know the answer.
Yeah, this is Matt Kissinger for the record, Senator Klayman through the chair. The Class 6 wells, as I mentioned, there are two ways you can earn the credit, through the permanent geologic storage or through EOR credits. The Class 6 wells are needed for the permanent geological storage. And so this gas, if used as EOR in the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir, would just be sent through the Prudhoe Bay system and into either existing injector wells or new injector wells. Those wells would not need to be Class 6 wells, as far as I understand.
Senator Klayman, my understanding is AOGCC has achieved authorization for Class 6 well, but let me confirm that. It's been a couple months since I last spoke to them, and I do have another inquiry out to them related to Great Bear. So I'll ask that question in the next day or so. Senator Bulikowski.
Thank you. Going back to Senator Dunbar's question, on lease expenditures. Could you get us a chart that had the amount of lease expenditure, the cost of lease expenditure deductions to the state per year from this project?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, we will provide our assumptions around incremental lease expenditures associated with the project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Yes, the lease expenditures, but also the loss in revenue to the state from those lease expenditure costs.
Yes, we will, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we will include the increase or decrease in revenue associated with the lease expenditures.
Any further questions on this page? All right, I think we're ready to go on to slide 33.
All right, again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. Moving on to slide 33. So this gets at some of the questions around uncertainties of assumptions around the AKLNG project. Two of the biggest assumptions that we've identified have uncertainty around them are what the gas price will be that the producers receive, and how much the project will actually cost. I know there's some discussion yesterday of potentially some different numbers running around. So we don't have, within Department of Revenue, we don't have final or confidential numbers on those two items. So we prepare some extensive sensitivity analysis. So we show on the top, what we're showing here is the break-even price for the cost of supply. That we'd shown on previous slides. On this chart, we're showing that in-state cost of supply, and we are varying the gas purchase price on the x-axis, which is how much do the producers receive for selling the gas into the project, and then we are varying the capital cost for the project. We start with our $46 billion capital cost assumption as our base CapEx, and we run increments of that of up to a 100% cost overrun. So you can look at what is the impact if there is a capital expenditure that's 20 or 40% higher than the baseline costs. So our baseline assumptions are the $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet for the purchase price, and then the $46 billion project cost. So in the baseline, this bill would reduce that in-state break-even price from $4.86 per 1,000 cubic feet down to $4.43 per 1,000 cubic feet. But then you can see the significant range of outcomes that are potential there and the risk to the developer for the higher capital costs in particular.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a question for Mr. Kissinger, just so we can put this in context. This break-even price. What is the sort of what is the international price that they'd be competing with right now?
Sure, I can take a stab at that, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. And I think there's been so this looks at the in-state price. So this would be the price to in-state utilities. I do have another. The next chart actually looks at the international LNG prices.
Wait, but the second one says Alaska. Oh, I see. It's Alaska LNG, but it's still in-state, even though the in-state users are not using LNG.
Right, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So we're showing the capital cost for the entire right. project, and then what is the delivered gas to in-state utilities?
Right, because it's all one project. Yes.
Right.
And Thank you.
The next slide will show the same, a similar chart looking at LNG sales into the global market.
So, Mr. Stickle, one of the concerns that we have is the phase one and it existing as an isolated occurrence. For the first few years, I think on your previous slide, 32 and 30, the first few years when it's in-state only, there's quite a loss. What is the price of... What is the break-even price there? What are Alaskans going to look at paying?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So I have some numbers based on a fall 2025 version of the analysis. We haven't fully completed the most updated spring version of the analysis, but the numbers should be fairly comparable. if the project were to build the pipeline, phase one only, and not proceed to the full project, we estimated a break-even gas delivered to utilities price of about $12.52 per 1,000 cubic feet.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
So just so I understand this, so the base, looking at the top one here, the base CapEx at $1.50, $4.86, that is that the delivered price to the consumer in South Central, or are you assuming other charges on top of that?
No, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So the prices here represent the delivered price to utilities. So this would be the cost that a utility such as NSTAR would be purchasing the gas for, and then the consumers would be paying a higher price that would represent the transportation cost that NSTAR has.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Do you have a rough estimate of what that number would reflect from 46 to what? 586, 686.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, not off the top of my head, I don't.
If you could get that, and then another
follow up.
I'm just curious. So you're assuming that are you assuming that cost overruns are going to be passed on to the consumers? Is that what this assumption is making?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, effectively, yes. So what this does is so the way this looks is we assume that the midstream operator will earn a 10% rate of return, and then we look at what is the price that would be required to allow them that 10% rate of return on different levels of capital costs. What would happen in reality? That's how we've done the modeling approach. What would happen in reality is the midstream operator would have a price that they would pay to the upstream. They would have a price that they would sell the gas for. They would have a cost of the project, and they would bear a lot of that risk at the midstream.
Follow up.
Right, because that was my understanding of the testimony, was that the cost overruns would not be passed to the consumers. So I'm not sure what to make of. With this chart, are you saying that if there's a 20% cost overrun, it won't be $5.43? If it's $1.50 gas, it'll be something different?
Sure. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So what we're showing here is, given if you assume a 20% cost overrun, for instance, and if you assume the $1.50 purchase price, for instance, then a $5.43 per 1,000 cubic feet would be required. That would be the price that the midstream operator would have to sell the gas for to get that 10% return. Now, they could sell it for a lower price and get less than a 10% return. And then under the bill before you, that break even in that scenario would go from $5.43 down to $4.92. So it would make a lower required price for them to earn that rate of return.
Follow up.
But just to be clear, you heard the same testimony I did, which was that cost overruns will not be passed on to consumers, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What volume of consumption are you assuming here from in-state?
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. Let me see if I have that number at my fingertips. I may need to defer that one. I'm sure Mr. Herbert has that at his fingertips.
Mr. Herbert? Mr. Herbert, can
you... Hello, for the record, David Herbert, Department of Revenue, through the chair. In the version of the model you have presented in front of you, we have an in-state sales demand of approximately 67 BCF per year, but growing over time.
Follow up, Madam
Chair. Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
So 67 BCF per year. But are you assuming – so you're not saying the whole project could survive selling 67 BCF per year at this price, right? This is basically – this chart cannot exist without the chart on the following slide where they are selling the full 3.5 BCF per day. Is that correct?
Sure. Again, Dan Sticker for the record, Senator Dunbar through the chair. Yes, that's correct. So these represent the in-state delivered sales – assuming the full project goes forward. And then again, if the full project didn't go forward and it was just the phase one, yes, the in-state prices would be significantly higher.
I guess my follow-up question will be on the second slide, next slide, Madam Chair. But I guess the point is sort of, this is an interesting slide because this slide cannot exist and none of this will happen unless what happens on the next slide goes forward, which is they are competitively selling a much, much larger volume of gas into the international market. And so that's my question about what price are they competing with goes to the next slide, but is tied to this slide in the sense that if they can't compete on the next slide, this slide doesn't exist. This doesn't happen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we just heard assuming the sellers wanted to maintain their projected 10% profit, the consumers will bear the cost of cost overruns, is what I just heard, right?
Senator Rauscher, through the chair. So,
but I guess what I'm trying to get through before I get the answer is, who is the consumer? The consumer could be whoever's purchasing overseas, as opposed to a different price, which we could get in state. Is that a possibility? I'm trying to understand the actual definition of the consumer and who's actually going to absorb the costs.
Sure. Senator Rauscher, through the chair. So first of all, no, we are not assuming that cost overruns would be borne by the consumer. So we've developed the model. It's based on the initial model was based on a tolling model for a regulated pipeline where there is a regulated return. We've basically modified this approach to modeling to the current project. And so what we're presenting here is if you assume a given sales price and a given construction cost, and if you assume a 10% rate of return, then sales price to utilities that would be required for the project to earn that 10% rate of return. And so this would be these in effect would be break even prices for Glenfarne. What would they need to sell the gas for to achieve their 10% rate of return? And as we've heard from them, no, the intent would not be to pass on cost overruns to the consumer. As far as who is the consumer, when we do the modeling, we're looking at sales to utilities. So for in-state sales, it would be sales to NSTAR, to Golden Valley, other utilities like that. For LNG, it would be sales to the utilities, potentially overseas.
Follow-up, Senator Rauscher.
Follow-up, thank you. So the bulk of the gas is going overseas.
Senator Rauscher's the chair, correct?
So they're basically going to accept the bulk of the extra cost?
Senator Rauscher through the chair. So the LNG market is a global market. And so the prices for the delivered LNG will be based on market prices. And so Glenfarne would go out and negotiate those contracts based on what the market will bear for delivered costs. They will negotiate the upstream prices with the producers, and they will outlay the funds to build the project. They will ultimately bear the risk of a cost overrun, unless they have a very unique contract arrangement where they could do some sort of cost sharing.
Thank you for the clarification.
Further questions? I just wanted to clarify. I had asked you the question, what if just the pipe were built, only the pipeline, and you said the break even for that would be $12.52.
Sure.
So is what I wanted to clarify, is that the price that would that NSTAR would pay if only the pipe were in the ground?
Yes, Chair Giesel, so to put a finer point on that, and these were based on the fall version of the model, so they're not exactly directly comparable to what you're seeing here, but the break-even price for in-state with phase one only would be $12.52 per 1,000 cubic feet under current law if the project went forward, and it would be $10.72 per 1,000 cubic feet under the proposed law.
And to clarify, that's the price to NSTAR, not the price to the consumer.
Chair Giesel, that's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. Further questions? Senator Klayman.
So there's several questions about that the consumer, meaning the gas user in NSTAR, the homeowner in NSTAR's example, isn't going to pay the cost overruns. Who is going to pay the cost overruns? Does that just mean in the 10% rate of return that you've calculated that they have to absorb those cost overruns in the 10% and reduce their margin, or does it get paid somewhere else?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, yes. So the assumption is that the midstream operator would have to absorb the cost overruns.
Senator Wilkowski.
Has Glenn Farn agreed to not seek a higher than 10% rate of return?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so the 10% rate of return, this would not be a regulated pipeline. The 10% rate of return is a modeling assumption that we've developed. So they could certainly get a higher than 10% rate of return. They could very well get a lower than 10% rate of return.
Follow up.
Who would decide what their rate of return is?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so given that it's not a regulated pipeline, the rate of return would be a function of the purchase price for the gas, the expenses to build and operate the pipeline, and then the selling price for the gas.
And is it the department's position that the RCA or FERC doesn't regulate this pipeline?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so my understanding is that this would not be a regulated pipeline. Happy to call on a lifeline for more details on that.
I believe Mr. Kissinger would be qualified to answer that question. Mr. Kissinger?
Yes, this is Matt Kissinger for the record. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. This project is a FERC-regulated project. It's regulated under Section 3 of the Natural Gas Act, and so it is not subject to RCA regulation. It is under the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
And my understanding is FERC doesn't regulate returns, so it would be up to the pipeline producer or the pipeline builder to decide what their rate of return is?
Mr. Kissinger?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the market will determine what returns are required to attract the investors. And so what we've done in coordination with Department of Revenue is take a stab at an assumption on what would be attractive to the market. But the market is also going to factor in their cost overrun risk exposure. So yes, the midstream will take on the cost overrun risk, but when the project is fully contracted, meaning all the upstream contracts, as Mr. Stickle mentioned, all the downstream contracts are in place and the EPC contracts constructed, there needs to be sufficient room to bear what is the perceived cost overrun risk by the investors.
Follow-up, Senator
Wilkowski. What we're trying to achieve here is to create sufficient room for that.
Follow-up?
We've heard throughout this presentation that the expected rate of return will be 10%. Is that what you expect it to be?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we've always assumed here at AGDC a 12% pre-tax rate of return and a 10% after-tax rate of return. But again, as we seek the investors at FID, that's when the market will make itself known. Those are somewhat standard infrastructure level rates of return for projects that are project financed with highly creditworthy counterparties.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's go back to the consumer, and the cost overruns wouldn't be borne by the consumer in an unregulated pipeline. Where does the consumer go to get assurance that, in fact, those costs have not been put onto their utility bill? And I'm not sure if this is Mr. Stickler or Mr. Kissinger.
I can take that one, Chair, if you would like. This is Matt Kissinger for the record.
That would be fine, Mr. Kissinger. Mr. Kissinger, could you take the question, please? You may be muted.
Stumped of disconnection.
Yes. While we're waiting, Senator Klayman, remember the Regulatory Commission of Alaska regulates NSTAR and the prices it charges consumers.
Apologies, Chair. I was having some technical difficulties. I don't think you could hear me.
Correct.
Senator Klayman, through the chair. It is our understanding the RCA regulates the gas sales agreements to the utilities. So the utility would take the application to the RCA, much in the same way they do now. So they take their application for Cook Inlet gas sales to the RCA. The RCA doesn't go and examine all the costs involved in and make a determination on whether the gas sale itself is fair and reasonable, is my understanding.
Senator Klayman.
Not a question, just a comment, but if you've got an unregulated pipeline that's coming in, the RCA really isn't in a position to say, well, they're charging too much for the gas that's coming in the pipeline and potentially putting in the costs that are very much showing up now in the consumer's bill. And RCA would say, well, where's the point at which we can say, no, this is not okay, because they actually don't regulate the pipeline that's getting it there. I just think that I have questions about the certainty that is the proposal that we wouldn't charge it to the consumer is just another day when somebody said, well, these were cost overruns. It's built into the pipeline, the gas price that's coming to NSTAR. NSTAR says this is the best price we could get, and it's got those very prices getting shared to the consumer.
Senator Klayman, it is my understanding, and I will confirm that if this were an in-state pipeline only, that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska would regulate it. However, the Glenfarn entity has gone to FERC and permitted this as a single project, which includes an export facility, which FERC does have jurisdiction over. My understanding is that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska will regulate what the rate of return to NSTAR is. They will tell them what the cost of the gas is that Glenfarn is selling it to them for, and then determine how much NSTAR can add to that to cover NSTAR's cost. That's where the RCA would come in. I can confirm that, and we can certainly invite an RCA commissioner to join us at the table, but that's my understanding. let's see. Questions. All right. Let's go to Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you.
I haven't had a question in a
Thank
while.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just because we're talking about RCA and then who would figure this out, and I don't know who can answer this, but is the spur line from wherever to Fairbanks going to be rate regulated through RCA, or is it just a FERC project? And then who with the – I mean, if it's a not with this AKLNG, but it's a spur, who regulates that? So, and I don't know who to ask.
Mr. Kissinger, do you have an answer to that question?
Yes, Chair. Matt Kissinger for the record. Chair Diesel, it is my understanding that would be, as you mentioned, an in-state gas pipeline, and so therefore would fall under the Alaska state statutes.
Okay. And maybe we'll clarify with RCA at some point. Thank you, Chair.
We absolutely will. And I have that understanding also that the RCA will regulate that gas pipeline. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. For Mr. Kissinger is just a hypothetical. And correct me if I'm wrong, but could we pass this bill? Could we pass a bill with the assumptions that we're given? And then it turns out, well, gas isn't really $1.50. It's $3. And the CapEx, the cost isn't really $46 billion. It's really $90 billion. And the rate of return isn't really 10%. It's 13 or 14%. And that would, I mean, is that theoretically possible that that could happen? The way the bill's currently written?
And you're asking Mr. Kissinger?
Yes.
Senator Wilikowski, for the chair, it's difficult for me to apply on so many hypotheticals. I apologize.
Okay. I'll break it down for you, Mr. Kissinger, if that's okay. Is it possible that the gas, instead of being $1.50, could be $3? Is that possible? Yes or no?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, it's I guess it's theoretically possible, but I find it difficult that we would be able to clear the market on the LNG side. Okay. So hypothetically, yes. Reasonably, no.
Senator Wilikowski.
Is it possible that the CapEx could be, instead of $46 billion, $80 or $90 billion? Yes or no?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I guess if we're dealing in pure hypotheticals, any number could result in almost any number. But again, I think it would be very difficult to clear the LNG market if the CapEx estimate was $90 billion and you also have cost overrun. We are now sitting on a class two cost estimate, which has a 15% accuracy rate band on it on the mainline pipeline. And we're moving into FEED on the gas treatment plant and the LNG facility. So once FEED is complete on those, I think we'll be able to opine with more confidence on the narrower band of what the CapEx should result in. I wouldn't expect that to be $90 billion.
And when can we expect that?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the developer is attempting to enter into FEED the middle part of this year on both the gas treatment plant and the LNG facility, and that FEED could take as long as 1 year to complete.
Follow up?
And when we heard earlier this year that pipe would start to be laid in December, is that being pushed back now?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, it's important to differentiate between the pipeline and the GTP and LNG subprojects. The pipeline subproject, as I said, has a class two cost estimate already on the mainline. And so, no, we're ready to move forward on phase one with that class two cost estimate on the mainline pipeline.
So you're ready to – so the pipe will still start to be laid in December of this year?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, as I've mentioned before, I don't like to deal in setting hard timelines for achieving an FID. I'd rather talk about the ingredients going into the FID and how those ingredients are progressing over time. So we've seen the gas sales precedent agreements with the upstream. Those need to be converted into definitive gas sales agreements. That's happening right now. We have the downstream gas sales agreement to NSTAR and industrial customers. Those negotiations are ongoing, and ultimately that will go into an RCA process. The RCA process will take a certain amount of time that is less manageable from our side, and so that all has to be factored in. Ideally, yes, by the end of the year, we would be on site.
I have questions now from Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Kissinger, I think you answered about half my question already. Appreciate that. But just to clarify, going back to kind of consumer protection, my understanding of the process and of what you just said was that before FID, you guys are you meaning you and Glenfarne, are going to have to sign firm binding contracts with Chew Gadget and Star and maybe a couple other customers in the South Central that I'm forgetting in order to go to FID on phase one. But before those contracts can get signed, NSTAR has to have them approved by the RCA, meaning that it would be extremely difficult for NSTAR, you know, for Glenfarne to pass the cost on to the consumer if there's any significant cost overruns, because that would require NSTAR or Chew Gadget or somebody to turn around and go back to the RCA and get those contracts reapproved and renegotiated. Is that correct?
Matt Kissinger, still for the record. Senator Myers, through the chair, I think that you captured it exactly how I understand it. So if I just can sort of repeat what you said for clarity, we would first enter into the gas purchase agreements and the gas sales agreements that underpin the financing on this project. We would then get the RCA approvals. We would get the financing. And if the project did have extreme cost overruns, it would not be a simple matter of turning around and just passing that cost on to the consumer, because the consumer, A, has a long-term contract in place, and B, that long-term contract requires the approval of the RCA.
Okay, thank you.
Next up is Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of what I was going to talk about, I think Senator Meyer covered, but also according to what Senator Clayman was talking about, I think the options are still out there. The whole idea behind this pipeline is to beat the cost of overseas, which I think is still an option if the price gets too high. I don't know if that's fact, but I think that's also an option. And then there's always whatever we have in the inlet, whatever's left of whatever we have in the inlet. I think those, they compete against each other. So I assume that they have to take those into consideration too. That's just opinion.
Senator Rauscher, this is a little off the subject, but I used to be a citizen listening in on these meetings not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And when speakers don't use their microphone, it's really hard to hear them. So yeah. I'm just saying, I don't know how the public is hearing you on that those last comments, but thank you for that. I do want to interject here that Nick Fulford with Gaffney Klein is online, and he sends a comment that he has slides on many of these questions and would be happy to jump in. I'm hesitant to do that because we do have Mr. Stickle at the table, and we still have more slides. So we will look forward to hearing from Mr. Fulford at our next hearing. So, any further questions? Right now, we're on slide 33. We can move on to slide 34.
Excellent. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle. So, slide 34 is our similar to what we had on slide 33, but looking at those LNG break-even prices. So, what would the price have to be into the market under different gas purchase prices and capital costs? This bill would reduce the break-even gas price for the developer from $9.07 down to $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet under our baseline assumptions. And yeah, correct. My understanding is Gaffney Klein has some excellent charts that kind of put those values into context. In terms of current and historical market prices globally.
Thank you. Questions on this slide? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is going to go to Gaffney Klein, but what is the current price? Maybe is a little bit not the best use because of what's going on in Qatar and elsewhere, but what is the current price that we would be competing with, and what's the projected price in 2033 we would be competing with?
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So I would defer some of those questions around exactly what we're competing against. I looked at futures market prices yesterday for delivered LNG into Asia. Currently, the prices are well over $10 per 1,000 cubic feet. especially over the very near term. There's a bit of a supply crunch. Once you go out into that early 2030s timeframe, the prices are lower. They're in the around $8 to $9 per thousand cubic feet range, and really highlights that these delivered prices are right on the margin of being competitive.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Just follow up.
And so this is also to, this is more to Mr. Kissinger. I'd like you to provide a little more detail about that. So let's say it's $10, we said, and it goes down because there are a bunch of other LNG projects that are coming online all over the world, including two potentially from this, from Glenfarne. So I guess my two questions are, what are you assuming to be the price you're going to be competing with? And then second, I'm still struggling with this idea that the previous slide, that Alaskans will really get that price when we're only 5% of the volume that's coming down the pipe. And so this is for you, Mr. Kissinger. Is there a world in which, let's say the South Central consumer in Alaska is getting gas out of this pipe that is more expensive than what we potentially could be importing from the LNG market?
Mr. Kissinger?
It's Matt Kissinger. Yeah, Matt Kissinger for the record. Senator Dunbar through the chair. On a full build out of the three train exports, I'd say no, that's not possible. We did have, in the Alaska Advantage principles, we have this concept of differential rates. So differential rates are where you can sell at a lower cost into one customer than another. For example, to bring on, we've talked about the Agrium plant. I think everyone would love to see the Agrium nitrogen plant back online. To do that under phase one, if in-state customers are paying in the $13 range, you would not be able to bring that plant on. So you use a tool called differential rates, and you go, well, what rate can they bear? For hypothetical purposes, let's say that's $6. So if they're paying $6, that would bring your in-state cost down from the $12, $13 range to the $10 range. So in that instance, and apologies, but the same could be done with a single train of LNG. So if you build with just the first train of LNG, you could kick it off that way. And hypothetically, in that situation, you could have overseas customers paying less for the gas than the in-state customers. But the way those different rates are allowed under this Alaska Advantage principles is only where they achieve the lowest possible rate for in-state utility customers. And so it has to be demonstrated that we're benefiting from those differential rates. Even though it's a very hard pill to swallow, we'd still need to be demonstrating that we're at least benefiting from those differential rates and bringing down the cost to in-state customers from where they would otherwise be.
Senator Dunbar, follow-up?
Yeah, two quick follow-ups. I assume that exists in law, that principle. And you as a state agency, I assume, would be answering to the rest of the state government on that. And if that's not correct, then let me know. And then second, you know, our Department of Revenue has made some, you know, these different break-even prices. Where is 8-Star assuming that the price will be in 2033?
Yes, Senator Dunbar through the chair. The way we look at the market is on the basis of the marginal supplier. So you don't look at who can supply for the cheapest price into the market, which in a lot of ways before the war was Qatar. They don't sell at that low price if they produce that, of course. They sell at the market rate. And the market rate gets set by whoever is producing into the market at the highest cost. That happens to be the U.S. Gulf Coast, generally. If you break down just the structure to go from Henry Hub pricing to delivered LNG into Asia. It goes something like this. You buy your gas at Henry Hub prices plus 15%. That 15% covers the fuel, the same way we had these questions earlier of Mr. Herbert around why, you know, why the costs are different. You still have to pay for your fuel in that Lower 48 model. So if you're thinking of around, you know, a $4, maybe $4 plus, just to make the math easier, Henry Hub price, which is a decent forecast for long-term Henry Hub, you'd be around $5 by the time it's going into the LNG plant because you're including that fuel. Liquefaction across the U.S. Gulf Coast is pretty standard. It's about $2.50 per MMBTU. So that puts you at $7.50 over there in the U.S. Gulf Coast, still needing to be delivered to Asia. And it's about $2.50 to deliver from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Asia, a lot of that driven by the impacts of the Panama Canal or having to go the long way to get there because you avoid the Panama Canal. So that achieves a delivered price into Asia of $10. But then you have to stress that, right? You have to be able to withstand periods of time when Henry Hub goes down to $2.50 like it does now. And you also have to take into account that a lot of LNG is also priced on Brent. So that's the math on U.S. Gulf Coast. Moving to the math on Brent, it's usually sold as a percent of Brent. And through casual reading, I think you'd be able to discover that the price band's fairly narrow. It's somewhere around 12, 13, sometimes 14, sometimes less, sometimes 11, 10% Brent. Let's use 12% Brent as our assumption now. So when you're $100 oil, you're paying $12 for the LNG. That's how that works. If you think of $75 oil, which is, I think, again, it's a long-term stable view of oil, that would be $9 for MMBTU. So what we're trying to beat is somewhere in that $9 to $10 range.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for that. I think that's a good summary. It does illustrate perhaps the necessity of this legislation, but it also sort of illustrates that, as Mr. Sigel just said, this is in some ways a marginal project. And if you go over 20% cost overrun, you're not really competitive, even at $1.50, and certainly not at $2 or $2.50. And so, it's good testimony for this bill. It sort of reiterates what I think a lot of us has been feeling, which is we are still skeptical that the private market will step in and invest in this project. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there further questions on this slide? Seeing none, we'll go to slide 35.
All right, Dan Stickle again for the record. Slide 35 is another one of these sensitivity charts. This shows total cumulative state revenue over the life of the project. Under current law, state and municipal revenues would increase substantially with higher project costs. So we assume that those higher project costs would feed through to higher property tax valuations. And so you see some upside to state revenues under current law. And then the flip side of that is, you know, risk to higher state taxes for the developer. Under this proposal, state and municipal revenues would be lower across the board, but then they would not increase if there were higher project costs. So we're basically, when folks are saying that the bill de-risks the project, that's what they're talking about, both the lower tax burden overall and then lower risk of facing higher taxes if the project value comes in higher than expected. You'd see a similar sort of chart if we did this for municipal revenues, but even bigger numbers, since the majority of the property taxes to the municipal owners.
I see no questions on this slide. Slide 36.
All right. So slide 36 is a tornado chart, another sort form of sensitivity analysis. What we did here is we looked at how certain key assumptions could impact that break-even in-state gas price. Again, under current law, starting with the $4.86 as our baseline price for delivered in-state gas. And we looked at property taxes, capital expenditures, that rate of return to the midstream, the purchase price of gas, and the interest rate paid on debt, and what higher or lower values for each of those would do to that break-even cost of supply. The biggest ways to reduce that required price for in-state gas would be through property tax relief and paying lower prices to the producers for the gas. The biggest risks to the upside would be higher than expected project costs and paying a higher value for the gas to the producers. And so you see this bill would de-risk that capital expenditures risk quite a bit, in addition to reducing the property tax burden.
Follow up, Senator Rauscher. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a sub-finance committee.
Oh, you're leaving. Gotcha. All right. Thank you for that. Are there any questions on slide 36? Seeing none. Moving to slide 37.
Excellent. Slide 37 is the same slide, but looking at the break-even LNG export price, $9.07 per 1,000 cubic feet being the current law baseline. And we see the impact of those key assumptions on that required cost of supply. Again, lots of risk to the upside in this project, and you can see from looking at the CapEx number in particular, why it's important to the developer to de-risk that CapEx, especially if they think there's a chance that that project costs could come in higher than the $46 billion that we've assumed.
And I'm looking at the cost of debt. I understand that there is some hope that the federal government will have some loan opportunities. And would that be at the lower interest rate? Where would that fall?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So we assume a 5% interest rate for that cost of debt. If there was some sort of reduction to that, we showed the impact of if those rates were brought down to 3.5%, that would, you know, materially impact the break-even prices. And then we showed the impact of a higher cost of debt as well. The 5% is a baseline assumption. It incorporates the known information around the federal loan guarantees that do exist. Obviously, if there was additional support that would be enacted, that would be a positive to the project.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Klayman?
Could you repeat the baseline price for the LNG export chart, this one?
Sure. Senator Klayman, through the chair, so $9.07 per 1,000 cubic feet in 2033 is our current law baseline, and so that's where we start this tornado chart.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to slide 38.
Okay, slide 38 shows a summary of total government revenues under this bill, and we show this over 10, 20, and 30 years of full production from the project. This is a summary of a snapshot of a detailed summary document that we've provided as a committee document, and we've split that into two slides here to make it reasonable.
Senator Wilkowski.
Looking at the upstream corporate income tax, what would that number be if all the producers on the North Slope were paying a corporate income tax?
Sure. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it would be about 50% higher. Roughly speaking, about two-thirds of the producers are paying corporate income tax.
Follow-up.
What would that number for project corporate income tax look like if the pipeline developer or all the others involved in this project were paying a corporate income tax?
Sure, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So we can provide that. We have we haven't calculated that out here. We are assuming conservatively that the midstream would pay zero corporate income tax.
Thank you. If you could provide us with the alternate assumption that they would pay a corporate income tax. Senator Wilkowski, nothing further? Anyone? All right. I'll let you go on.
All right. And then slide 39 is just the second half of this chart. Again, this entire analysis has been provided as a committee document. But through the 30-year modeling period, looking at a total of $22.5 billion of state benefits over the life of project, and then nearly $4 billion to the municipalities over life of project, and federal government income tax benefits netting about $22 billion over life of project. So a total of $48 billion to the various governments through 2062.
Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, if you're going to provide us numbers about if the midstream was paying the corporate income tax, could you also provide an estimate of what that would do to the gas cost, both for in-state and for LNG sales?
Senator Myers, to the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Looking at the oil production tax, why is that a decrease of a couple hundred million dollars from 2052 to 2062?
Sure. Senator Wilkowski, to the chair. And so these are positive impacts above and beyond the revenue forecast. And so what our modeling does is that it accounts for all of the impacts of the ability of companies to deduct lease expenditures against the oil tax. It accounts for all of the impacts of per taxable barrel credits. And so going from the 2052 to the 2062 time frame, we see a net increase in the production tax paid to the state overall. When you combine the oil and the gas pieces, but some of the lease expenditure deductions and per taxable barrel credits do reduce the oil side of things. So in our modeling, we calculate out the gas production tax, the 13% gross tax. We calculate out the oil tax net of everything, and then we add them together to get the total production tax impact.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
But am I reading that correctly? That there, so oil production tax is $1.6 billion positive through 2052, but then it declines by $275 million through the next 10 years.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yeah. So from the 2053 to 2062 timeframe, we do expect a reduction in oil production tax relative to the forecast, but that will be more than offset by increase to gas production tax.
So are you, Mr. Stickle, is this reflecting the deductions they can take against their oil taxes as they produce more gas?
Sure, Chair Geisel. So our modeling accounts for the fact that under our current production tax law, any incremental lease expenditures associated with gas development can be deducted against the oil tax calculation. We also account for the nuances of the per taxable barrel credits, which those are generated based on oil production and applied based on the statewide tax calculation. And so both of those factors are built into our modeling.
Thank you. Further questions on 39? Seeing none, we'll go to 40.
All right. Slide 40 is a conclusion slide. Mm-hmm. So the AKLNG project, if it was constructed, it would provide billions of dollars to the state and the federal government and local governments. It would provide a new revenue stream to the upstream producers and a new revenue stream for a midstream developer. It would provide jobs and support energy security in the state and nationally. This bill would reduce the tax burden on the developer, making the project relatively more economic, and would help de-risk the project in terms of reducing the potential impacts of higher project costs or higher tax assessments.
Thank you. The next few slides are sectional, which we don't have to go through. I do want to ask you a question, however, on slide 46. And this relates to Alaska Statute 4356-022. And this is where it imposes a replacement of all state and municipal property, ad valorem, et cetera, taxes. It's all written there. Looking at this, it's unclear to me whether this is confined to certain oil and gas properties or if this applies across the state. Would it be applying then to qualified property under that definition that is in Cook Inlet, for example, or in Middle Earth?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So I can speak to what my understanding of the intent is. So the intent is, if you look at current property tax law, there's language in the statutes that property taxes in lieu of other similar taxes. That's kind of the intent, is a fairly narrow exclusion. So municipalities, the volumetric tax would be in lieu of the property tax or similar taxes. And so the intent of that is not to provide an extremely broad exclusion, but a narrow exclusion. And I think we've got Department of Law on who can opine on in further detail if that's helpful.
It would be. Let's see. Ryan Farnsworth is online with the Department of Law. Mr. Farnsworth, how broadly can this exclusion be applied?
Thank you, Chair Giesel. This is Ryan Farnsworth, Department of Law. Is the question about the abatement, property tax?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's on slide 46, but it's section 4356-022. It seems very broad. It pertains to purchase, use, consumption, or ownership of property or services in that municipality or jurisdiction. Seems very broad.
It is a broad exemption, yes.
So, could it be applied to, let's say, the Glen Farne or AGDC has an employee that lives in Bethel, and they come to work for 2 weeks in Kenai. They're building the export facility. And so they are going to go to buy some groceries. Okay, so we're talking now about consumption, right? Purchase, use, consumption. Can they be waivered? Can they receive a waiver on the property or the municipal sales tax when they go back to Bethel as well, or only in the Kenai borough, or how will that apply to the employee?
I don't think the employee would be exempted from sales tax for lunch purchased while working. It would have to be property that's have to be something contributed to the project by contract. So perhaps catering for a large event, something like that for the project, but I don't think individual lunches would be exempt.
Okay, but that is not defined here. You're making an assumption because of course regulations haven't been written to apply this. Is that true?
Well, no, because the alternative, the exemption from the tax is related to the qualified property. So it has to be related to the property, the project, or something associated.
All right. Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask another hypothetical that's a little bit more direct. If Glen Farne brought in a bunch of contractors that, again, were working directly on the project, and they stayed in Anchorage for a week in hotels, would they be exempt from our bed tax?
I would say no to that.
But why? I mean, just the way it's written here, I don't understand why they wouldn't be.
I don't think that that use is associated with the project.
I don't understand why having construction or contract employees that are directly working on the project wouldn't be associated with the project. Are you saying it has to be something physical, physically attached to the project?
Not necessarily. It may depend who's paying that bill. If the project's paying the bill or the individual.
Follow up,
Madam Chair. Yes, follow up, Senator Dunbar.
What about Anchorage's gas tax? If you're filling up a bunch of trucks headed to the project, carrying things for the project, are they exempt from Anchorage's gas tax?
That's probably a level of detail that isn't in this statute, this draft.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any other questions about any of the sectional? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
I'm curious if the Department of Revenue included in their modeling how much this section would cost the municipalities or the state.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So we modeled to what I understand is the intent of the section. Understand that it, there may be an amendment to tighten up the language here that would be helpful. I did have discussions with the governor's office to understand what was intended here. And the intent is a narrow exemption, basically to disallow a property tax by another name. The AVT would be a replacement for the property tax and the type of property that would be taxable under a property tax. The intent is not to include bed taxes and sales taxes and things like that. And so when we did our modeling, we modeled to that intent. And so we looked at the reduction to the property tax and then the imposition of the alternative volumetric tax.
Senator Wilkowski.
Different topic, but just a request.
Could I the follow-up then, sure. Just briefly on that? So you're saying that's the intent, but would you agree that that intent is not actually fleshed out in this statement of a statute?
Chair Giesel, we would need to put regulations into place. I would suggest that we would look at that intent when crafting those regulations. But if we wanted to put the additional clarity into statute, that could be certainly helpful.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
A request for the department, if they could get us. Slide 33 was the sensitivity matrix for in-state gas at as of 2033. That's phase two. And I'd like to see that chart for phase one. I think that'd be beneficial to the committee. So do you understand that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So this would be a phase one only if the full project did not proceed.
Correct.
We are in the process of preparing that modeling, and okay. When it's ready, we will present that.
And then I had a question for Mr. Kissinger.
Yes, perhaps. Mr. Kissinger.
Yeah. So I've heard from constituents and other legislators that there are ads running on the radio and on political blogs urging support for the LNG projects, and I'm just curious, who's paying for those?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it's my understanding that Glenn Farm are paying for those. Sorry, this is Matt Kissinger for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Kissinger. Senator Wilkowski, follow up.
Is AGDC paying for those in any way, or have you approved of those?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we have neither approved them nor are we paying for them.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Clayman, you had a question.
So I want to go back to the discussion about regulations. Mr. Stickle, there's this theme that we often hear, the regulations have to comply with the law and the regulations can't do more than the law. And if we have regulations that do one thing and the law doesn't go that far, then there's a lawsuit and says, well, those regulations are improper. If we're concerned that this as drafted is too broad, why would we rely on regulations to straighten it out?
Senator Clinton, through the chair, again, Dan Stickle for the record. I'm an economist, not a lawyer.
I was relying on economists for economic advice.
Right. And if I were involved in the regulation process, I shared what my view would be and what the intent and direction from the administration was in this. Certainly we'd be happy to look at potential amendments to strengthen up that language to make sure that it does indeed match what the intent is.
Very good. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, that concludes our agenda for today. We did have Gaffney Klein scheduled, obviously did not get to that, so we will reschedule that at another time. We have lots of questions that we will be pursuing related to the RCA and AOGCC, and then, of course, Department of Revenue will be getting us additional information. So at this time, we will stand adjourned. We will be meeting tomorrow, April 15th, tax day, at 3:30 p.m., the usual time, this room. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect it is 11 a.m.